Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, welcome back. This is hour three of the program, and as you can see, time goes very quickly, so please feel free to call me. I'd love to talk to you. I'm back from vacation. All is well. I am tanned, rested, and ready for your phone call. 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Now, I mentioned that, well, before the break, I mentioned the story in the news this past few days about Nancy Pelosi having, or I guess saying that she asked one or more priests to come to her home and exorcise it. She lives in San Francisco. And you probably, I mean, you've heard the story about some crazed guy who broke into their house. At least the public story is he broke into the house and attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, with a hammer. And it's a terrible story. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But that has led to many different theories about what was really going on. And I really don't know what was going on. I really don't. But I just mentioned before the break, the story in the news is that Nancy Pelosi said that she needs to have her house exorcised of demons. So my reaction to that is, I'm not surprised. And this has nothing to do with the hammer attack. But, I mean, I had no idea where Nancy Pelosi lived. I'd never seen a picture of her home. I was never interested. But since that story came out, you know, you've seen the pictures of her suburban. Well, she's not even suburban. She lives in the city, I believe. And she wants her house exercised. I could understand why. So with that in mind, I won't go back over that ground, but this puts me in mind of some tweets that came out yesterday from El Presidente, President Biden, and this is the @POTUS Twitter account. And I'm just going to read to you what he says. Now, keep in mind, he too, like Nancy Pelosi, he's a Catholic, and he makes a big deal out of it. And any chance he gets, he reminds people, hey, I'm a devout Catholic. Really? So here's what he said in his tweets. He says, today should have been the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Instead, MAGA Republican officials are waging a war on women's rights to make a woman's right to make her own. Actually, he doesn't say her, their own healthcare decisions. I guess that's grammatically correct. Women's and their would be the correct grammar. So fair enough. So just to reread it, today should have been the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Instead, MAGA Republican officials are waging a war on women's right to make their own healthcare decisions. But this fight isn't over. Next tweet. From the minute Roe was overturned last June, our administration fought to protect access to abortion where we could, including taking executive actions to safeguard access to medication, abortion, and travel to access reproductive health care services. Next tweet. He said, since then, anti-choice bills have cropped up in state houses across America, including proposals restricting access to contraception. And in Congress, MAGA officials are touting a national ban with the goal of blocking women everywhere from making their own healthcare choices. Next quote on his Twitter, let me be clear, he says, a woman's right to choose is non-negotiable. By the way, so is going to hell, by the way. Just FYI, going to hell is non-negotiable. Once you get there, you have no room to negotiate. He says, let me be clear. A woman's right to choose is non-negotiable. I haven't stopped fighting to protect women's reproductive rights, and I never will. Now it's time for Congress to pass legislation codifying the protections of Roe. So these are the ravings of a Catholic. He's a brother in Christ. He's baptized. He's received his sacraments. I hope and pray that I see Joe Biden in heaven. I hope and pray you see me in heaven, for that matter. So I'm concerned for the state of his immortal soul the way I would be for anyone else under these circumstances. But he just happens to be the president. He just happens to have a bully pulpit like Nancy Pelosi has. So back to my point earlier, whether you're Republican or Democrat or whatever, it doesn't really matter. If you're a Catholic and you are at the forefront of promoting an evil like abortion, is it any wonder that you might have some stuff going on in your house that might need an exorcism? Makes sense to me. Lila Rose, by the way, a great woman and a great figure in the pro-life movement, she responded to what President Biden said by saying, shameless, a grandfather and leader of the free world, a self-professed Christian, mourning the fact that some children are alive today because a vicious and evil ruling was overturned. This is worse than Herod. That's exactly right. Thank you, Lila Rose. It's exactly right. I mean, just think about this for a second. He and Nancy Pelosi both are grandparents. Who knows, maybe by now she might be a great-grandparent, I'm not sure, but as a grandfather myself, the very thought of one of my grandchildren perishing in abortion is just, it's intolerable. And it should be for every thinking human being, whether you're Catholic or not. You don't have to be Catholic to recognize the evil of this situation. So the story about the exorcism, it fits naturally within this construct. And I'll leave it at that. I mean, there's really nothing more I have to say on that issue, but it's in the news right now, so I thought I would comment on it. Oh, by the way, you've asked, not that you've asked me about this per se, but just I want to acknowledge the fact that a Catholic journalist by the name of George Neumeier, may he rest in peace, he died seemingly suddenly over the last couple, three, four days ago. His last name is spelled Neumayr, and he was a Catholic Catholic journalist. He wrote for the American Spectator and other publications. He, you know, traditional Catholic, conservative Catholic, however you want to call him, and he died of malaria, seemingly all of a sudden. He was in Africa doing some investigative journalism over there, and he was, you know, tweeting a lot of stuff on his Twitter feed and a lot of stuff on Facebook and other things. In fact, we'll get a link to this. And the eerie thing about this is that, number one, it's saying it was confirmed that he was sick. He talks on his Twitter feed. He has died, of course, but he talked on his Twitter feed several days ago about how he got food poisoning. And he was very, very sick for a day or two. It is confirmed that he was diagnosed with malaria. He didn't go to the hospital. He didn't want to be treated. The U.S. consulate tested his body after his death, and he tested positive for malaria. He was in his late 50s. So by the look of him, I never met George Neumeier, but he looked to be in reasonably good shape, reasonably good health. But, you know, his late 50s, and he's in a foreign country where maybe sanitation wasn't helping him in this regard. But anyway, he died suddenly, and it has the appearance of a kind of a mysterious death. And the reason it does is because in Twitter comments that he made on there and elsewhere online, he was saying that he, in his investigations into some of the murky areas, let's say, of behind-the-scenes stuff going on with corruption in the church, and he said he was doing some dangerous stuff. He thought his life might be in danger. And in one tweet, he says, if anything happens to me, you'll know that it wasn't, you know, that it's related to the work that I'm doing. So that's part of what makes this story, really, it's the main thing that makes this story mysterious. And so we know what we think we know at this point anyway, but I wanted to mention this to you because he was a prominent figure and he's not with us anymore. So let's pray for the repose of his soul and wait to see what comes of all this. But I just wanted to mention that in passing. We'll get a link to this from Catholic World Report so that you can follow along with it if you're interested. The show Twitter feed, by the way, is at P Madrid Show. You'll be able to find it there. Let's go over to Lily now in East Chicago. East Chicago, Indiana. Good morning, Lily. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. I'm going to get straight to the point. Last night, my husband and I were arguing, and he got physical, so he hit me. And my question is, like, where does one go from here? Like, we have an 8-month-old and a 7-year-old. Mm-hmm. And what does one do? Like,
Your husband, like, you and your husband were fighting, and he punched you or slapped you or hit you?
He slapped me.
Okay. Well,
like, I feel really lost because we're married. Like, I can't just get up and leave, or do I leave? Mm-hmm. What's your advice?
Okay. My first advice, number one, are you and your husband, I mean, did he leave, or are you still under the same roof together?
Yeah, we're still, he left to work. He didn't want to leave last night, and I didn't want to leave with the kids.
Yeah. How many children?
Like we have two. We have a 8-month-old and a 7-year-old.
Okay. I'm so sorry that this happened, Lily, and it's terrible. It should not have happened. Your husband did something terrible, and you should not have been victimized this way. So one thing to keep in mind is that that's a crime. So the first thing that I would do if I were you would be to involve law enforcement. And the reason I say that is because if you've been victimized this way, and chances are maybe other things have happened that led up to this, was there any verbal violence, verbal abuse leading up to this?
He is verbally abusive.
Yeah. So your safety is at risk, all the more so now. So there are agencies that are available in your area. Well, everywhere they're available for women and children in a situation like that. So you can get in touch with the local police department. They can give you a referral for some of these agencies that can provide assistance to you. If okay. So keep in mind that what he did is a crime, number one.
Yes. I know. I don't want to sound like I want to, like, sweep it under the rug, because this is like a line that he crossed, but I can't even look at him the same way.
Right.
I don't even want to look at him. But
I can't imagine.
I know we're married, and it's a fact. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just so lost.
Yeah. I've never been in this situation, and I can't say from direct experience, but I do know, just common sense says that if you're in this situation now, then you and your children are at risk. So the last thing I would ever want to do would be to do anything that might jeopardize a marriage. And of course, he's the one that's put the marriage in jeopardy, not you or me, certainly not you. You're the victim. But you have a right to be safe. You have a right to be, if necessary, separated from him. If this is something he's done it, and if he's going to continue to do it, you have a right to be separated from him. And interestingly, Lily, the church has a provision in canon law for what's known as a canonical separation. It's not a divorce.
Okay.
But you have the right, by the way, under the church's teaching, to separate from him. Since he has crossed this line, he does not have a right to demand do you know what I mean by the marital debt? Does that phrase mean anything to you?
No, Patrick.
Okay. So what it means is that when you get married, the husband and the wife grant each other, you give yourself to your husband, he gives himself to you in the marriage. So you have the right to each other's bodies. You have the right to live together as man and wife, sexually, sharing your finances, having children. They often will refer to it as bed and board. You share bed, you share board with each other. So he has now forfeited that right. So you have, and the church recognizes that you have, a right to separate from the conjugal life that you were leading prior to this with all that entails. Now, hopefully the goal would be that he would get his head screwed on straight and repent and get into counseling and fix this problem that is going on with him, so that, God willing, you could resume a happy married life. But in the meantime, for your own safety and that of your children, you have this right to be separated until and unless that happens. I'm not trying to push you into separating, but I'm just saying you're in a vulnerable position right now, so you need to be protected from what's going on. Because if it happened last night where he slapped you, God forbid that it happens again and something worse. You know what I mean?
No, yes, I know. And that's what I'm afraid of, because, you know, if he did it once, I can't say that he won't do it again, because I never thought he would do it in the first place. So
I know.
And it's like, I don't know him.
It's so sad. I'm so sorry, Lillian. I'm truly sorry that you're going through this. Do you have family nearby, your mom or dad nearby, or anybody that you can turn to?
I have a really good support system. My sister already offered me her apartment, so.
Okay. Okay, good.
So yeah, I have my family.
Okay, good, good, good. So you have a you have a safe place that you can go and be not under the same roof with him?
Yes. Okay. I can do that.
Okay. So my advice, Lily, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have any standing in that regard, but just as a fellow human being, I want you and your children to be protected. And so my advice would be call the police, get them involved, let them know what happened, and start the process of getting these agencies involved so that they can help you and protect you. And sometimes these things need a restraining order. Sometimes they need something even more stringent than that. But that process will help you figure out what's the next step. Are you registered at a Catholic parish?
Yes. I'm going to go see if I can find our priest. He's really good with us. So
good, 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 good. Yeah, counsel with him. Counsel with him.
Yeah.
Ask him, you know, what would you recommend? Again, this is the issue of a canonical separation is a canon law issue, but he can help you with that. But I'm not in any way advocating that you end the marriage, far from it. But until your husband gets his mind right and stops doing this and repents and shows you that he's trustworthy, you have a right and a need to be protected and separated from this violence.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your advice, Patrick.
You're welcome. Plug in with all these people. Plug in. Get things moving. Get people involved. You know, the worst thing you could do, it seems to me, Lily, would be to kind of sweep it. Like you said, you don't want to sweep it under the rug, pretend it didn't happen, and keep it to yourself, because then you become even more vulnerable.
Yes. No, I know that. I'm not going to sweep it under the rug.
Right.
It's just a line that was crossed that is just really hard to go back.
Yes. I'm at a loss for words to know what to say when a husband does something so ridiculous and devastating like this. Just my heart goes out to you.
Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope that you can pray for my children and I.
I will do so. I promise you that. Hang in there, Lily. Can you call me back in a couple of weeks and let me know how things are going?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Lily. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Young Thomas, if a guy stopped you on the street and said, "Young Thomas, what do you think is America's most trusted profession?" What would you say?
What do I think is America's most trusted profession?
Yeah. And you can't say radio host, because that's an easy answer.
The producer who does the radio.
Well done. But you would be wrong.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
So according to Gallup, you know, the opinion poll people, who do you think, what profession do you think is at the top in terms of the most trusted?
I feel like a lawyer, maybe.
Not a lawyer. Lawyers are in the middle.
Oh, actually, they're in the middle. That's actually impressive. Mm-hmm. Doctor?
Yeah, very, very close. It's actually nurse. So nurses are at the very pinnacle of, in terms of this study that was done by Gallup. They did a, it's a reoccurring poll. They do it every so often. And they ask Americans, what do you think is the most trustworthy profession? So here goes. At the top, nurses, 79%, followed by doctors, 62%, followed by high school teachers, 53%. Although in the age of libs of TikTok, that perception could change over time. So high school teachers, 53%. No disrespect to high school teachers, by the way. Thank you for all the good work that you do. Those of you who are doing good work, thank you. We're grateful to you teachers for what you do for our children. Just, you know, the good teachers. I'm not talking about the bad teachers. Police officers, I'm happy to see them, but only at 50%. Only 50% of the people surveyed said that they regard them as a trustworthy profession. I certainly do. Does that mean that there aren't bad cops? No, of course not. There are. Always have been, always will be. But by and large, in general, I certainly do have a high degree of trust for police officers. 50% of Americans say so. Judges, 39% of Americans say that they are trustworthy. Lawyers clocks in at 21%. And now it starts going into the negative territory. Labor union leaders, only 24% of Americans say that they have, that they regard them as highly trusted. Business executives, 14% of Americans surveyed say that they are a trusted profession. Journalists, 23%. Car salesmen, 10%. Telemarketers, 6%. And although it's not at the bottom of the heap when it comes to those who say that they have a high degree of trustworthiness, members of Congress, only 9% of the Americans surveyed said that they have a high degree of trustworthiness. But on the negative side, 62%. So let's invert this now and go from the bottom up. The category that is considered the least trustworthy is members of Congress, 62%, followed by telemarketers, 59%, car salesmen, 44%. I have a good friend who's a car salesman, and he's a super guy. Journalists, 42%. So there's a great deal of distrust for journalists, according to this survey. So if you're interested, it breaks it down. Gets into all kinds of other things, like pharmacists. Pharmacists typically earn higher trust ratings than doctors. Before 2013, they've ranked slightly below doctors since the pandemic, and they now register their lowest rating in four decades of measurement. So pharmacists are going downhill. I don't know why. Real estate agents, bankers, we mentioned police officers, labor union leaders, lawyers, accountants, business executives, clergy, they're all in there. And you can see that people's perception of these different professions, in some cases increasing, in some cases is decreasing. And as you might guess, it also is driven by party politics. So, for example, Democrats are far more likely to think that journalists are trustworthy than Republicans do. It's interesting, if I could get the words out of my mouth. So it's there on the show Twitter feed if you're interested in looking at it, at P Madrid Show. Let's go now to, oh, you know what? I have one other thing I need to read to you before we proceed to the phone calls. This is coming in from a lady who listens to us in Austin, Texas. She sent this to me this morning, and she was listening earlier today when I read the email from the man whose wife, they've been married for 30 years, bunch of kids, Catholic, regular mass goers, all of the above, about as good as it gets. And she wound up having an affair. I don't know if it ever became physical, but it certainly was an emotional affair with some guy online. So I read that article. I'm sorry, I read that email from the gentleman who's writing in about that. So this is from a lady. I won't say her name, but she listens in Austin. She says, I was the adulterous wife. She says, I was listening to the story about the gentleman who found out his wife was having an affair. Same thing happened in my marriage, but I was the adulterous wife. I was so far away from God that I truly didn't care about anything. My husband found out and stayed for the family. Since then, I have come to know God and his love, and I have turned my life around, thanks in part to all of you at Relevant Radio. Our marriage will never be the same, but I pray every day for his broken heart. The caller needs to know that our sin blinds us and the deceiver makes us believe that we don't love our husbands, but deep down we do. Well, I'm so glad to hear that this has a somewhat of a happy ending. At least the two of you are still together. The man who wrote to me earlier today, it sounds like his marriage broke up over this. So thank you for putting a personal touch on this issue. And maybe your email will be great in a way of encouraging other women, and men too for that matter, who are finding themselves wanting to take a walk on the wild side. Don't do it. Don't take a walk on the wild side. Don't start up with that old flame on Facebook. Don't do it. The stakes are way too high, and a lot of other people are going to suffer if you do that. Let's get back to the phones. Let's go to Anna now in Nevada. Good morning, Anna. Hello, Anna. Welcome. Maybe Anna's not married. Maybe, I don't mean she's not married. Maybe she's not ready. So perhaps you can sort her out, Gabby or Sarah. Take a look at Anna.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.
But that's not true, because it's not over. We're going to get Anna on the air. Let's go to Maria now in Central California. Good morning, Maria.
Hi, Patrick. I am a longtime listener, although somewhat sporadic, but I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I was at Mass this weekend, and during Mass, right before communion, it was identified that the pyx had disappeared from the tabernacle. Okay. And at the end of Mass, the priest announced that this had happened. And he said that if, you know, we couldn't locate the pyx, that he would need to shut down the church for a month. And I wasn't sure or clear why that would need to happen. But
the parish priest said he would close the church down because the sacred vessel is missing?
Yes, it would be closed for a month and just, you know, for punishment.
What?
For punishment. Yes. Yeah.
So, okay. So presuming, and I'm coming into this cold, Maria, so maybe there's some more details that would help me understand this, but based on what you're saying, somebody stole the pyx. Now, for those who don't know, pyx, P-Y-X, it's a little sacred vessel. Typically, it would be made out of metal. Think of like a pocket watch that the men would wear in the olden days, and the cover lifts off, and inside there, this small little vessel is where the consecrated host would be put to take to somebody who's sick in the hospital, for example, or somebody who's at home bedridden to help them to give them Holy Communion. That's what she's referring to, that pyx. So do I have this right, Maria? Because some bad person stole it, or at least it appears to be stolen, it's possible it got misplaced somehow. Do I have it right that the priest is going to punish everybody in the parish who obviously didn't steal the pyx by depriving them of Mass and the sacraments? Can that be true?
Yes, so that's why I'm calling, because I didn't quite understand. Again, I don't know what the outcome was, because this was this weekend, so I don't know if it was eventually found, but it appeared that it might have been very likely taken. And so he said in kind of short order that the church would need to be closed down because it would be viewed as desecration to the church. And as a form of punishment, the church would be closed for a month.
Okay. Well, my reaction is that's crazy, but I recognize that there may be some extenuating circumstances that you haven't told me, maybe because you don't know what they are, but at face value, that's crazy. I mean, you didn't steal the pyx. The 950 other people, or 1,000 or 2,000, however many people in that parish, didn't steal the pyx. It's unjust and inappropriate for this quote-unquote punishment to be levied against the innocent parishioner simply because some bad person did that. It makes no sense at all. To deprive you of the sacraments? I mean, you have a Sunday obligation to go to Mass on Sunday, and the parish priest doesn't have the authority or the competence to say, sorry, you guys don't get to go to Mass on Sunday because I'm punishing you. Something's not right with this picture. I don't know what it is, but I've never even heard of such a thing.
I tried to apply logic to it, and I couldn't. So I wanted to get your thoughts on it, and so that's kind of along the lines. I don't know what the final outcome is going to be of this, but
How is this quote unquote punishment communicated to the parishioners? Was it in the bulletin or how were you told?
No, so this just happened at Mass and it was at the close of the Mass. So it was identified just before communion by one of the Eucharistic ministers, communicated it to the priest. And so at the close of Mass, he announced that it was missing. And if there was some kind of sinister, you know, if it completely disappeared, never to be found, appeared to be a sinister act, it would be considered desecration to the church, and that as a form of punishment, the church would be closed for a month.
It's possible that what he said and what you heard might be on two different wavelengths here. No, that's not correct, because if a church is desecrated, so let's say that something evil takes place inside a church, and we've heard stories of things like that that have happened in recent months and years, then yes, the church will reconsecrate the church. So there is a special ritual that the church has for that very purpose, but this doesn't fall under that category, because if a sacred vessel is stolen, or let's say somebody steals something like that, it doesn't trigger the need to reconsecrate a church. It's still terrible, but something would have to be done to the church itself, or some terrible act perpetrated in the church itself, and theft is not one of them. So my advice would be, because something is not adding up here, something's not quite right, what I would do is, if you're not getting any traction with the parish priest, would be to write a letter to your bishop and say, do you know what's going on here? Are you aware of this, that we're going to be quote-unquote punished because somebody stole a pyx? I would ask your bishop for a follow-up on this. That's what I would do if I were in your situation. But something's not right here. It sounds like there's some missing piece of information that might make this...
It was just evolving, you know, during Mass and at the close of Mass. So this is what was communicated by the priest. But what I didn't understand is that the closing of the church and the desecration was tied to punishing the parish.
This makes no sense.
Didn't.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. That's what I'm saying. This does not compute. So perhaps it's just simply the fact that in a misguided sort of way, the priest thinks that that's the right way to go about this. And obviously you can tell that I disagree with that logic. There's no need to quote unquote punish the innocent people for something they didn't do. And it doesn't sound like, based upon what you're saying, that there was any desecration. There was no desecration of the church simply because something sacred was stolen from the church. That's bad. That's reprehensible, but it doesn't amount to the desecration of the church. So maybe contact your bishop and get further clarity on this. What a strange situation. I've never even heard about that kind of thing before, Maria. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Ed in Minnesota. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I got a question. This past Sunday, yesterday, we went to Mass, and our parish priest did not show up. And so one of our parishioners called the priest, and he said he was out of town, and he had left a message for one of the a retired priest to fill in, and the retired priest must not have got the message, so we didn't have a priest.
Okay.
So they had a communion service. And my question is, I'm not real familiar with communion services. And also, did that fulfill our Sunday obligation to go to Mass?
No. Let's start there. So no, it didn't, because the Sunday obligation is to go to Mass, not a communion service. Now, sometimes it's unavoidable due to distance, or it could be anything. It could be the illness of a priest, could be bad weather, you could be sick, there could be any number of reasons that would prevent you from getting to Mass. So if it happens, Ed, that you went to your parish and they had a communion service, and there is no reasonable opportunity to get to Mass somewhere else, then your obligation in essence is commuted. It is, I don't know if dispensed is exactly the correct term for it, but you didn't fulfill your obligation, but it was beyond your control. Therefore, there's no sin involved or anything. You did the best you could under the circumstances. If there were, you know, let's say that you knew that a mile away at another parish there would be a mass an hour later, and you were aware of it, and you could have gone, that would have fulfilled your Sunday obligation. But these things do happen, and maybe it was just, it could have been an oversight on the part of the priest, could be that he did everything he should have done, and the priest who was going to help out forgot. That's possible. Could be that the priest who went away didn't fulfill his obligations by making sure there was somebody there to back him up, and maybe he was negligent. That happens too, I suppose, but not very often. But the main thing is that you were faced with what was available, which was a communion service. So based upon what you're saying, I don't see any reason to be concerned about that, but it would be in the same category as, let's say you were ill and you just couldn't get to Mass, or maybe you had a sick child and you had to stay home with the child and you couldn't go to Mass for that reason. There are situations where you didn't violate your Sunday obligation. This sounds like one of those. Now, communion service is typically led by a deacon, and that would have elements of the Mass. So there'd be some of the prayers from the Mass, including the Our Father and such, and you would receive Holy Communion, but there is no Mass. There's no consecration. None of those things that are integral to the Mass itself are present in a communion service. So does that help, Ed?
Well, it does. So if the person officiating, or whatever you want to say, the communion service is not a deacon, does he have to get some kind of permission from the bishop or something to be able to do that? Or?
Yeah, that's something that would be delegated typically by the pastor. But of course, the pastor's authority is an extension of the bishop's authority. The bishop is the one ultimately who makes such determinations. And normally, there are any number of deacons about, so it would be unusual that there wouldn't be some deacon available nearby who could lead the communion service. And this is done, and the bishop can authorize that. So it would be strange if there weren't a deacon nearby who could have done this. It would be extremely unusual in these United States, modern 21st century America, where there are so many deacons, that a parish would have to resort to a layperson doing this. That would be the last resort under some unusual situation. But I guess I'll have to leave it at that. We have to take a break, and we will be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls and maybe even a few more emails on the other side of this quick timeout. If you want to reach me, you'll find me on Twitter. My address there is @PatrickMadrid. I'd love to interact with you there, and I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
This is a band you should get to know, young Thomas.
Oh, is it
Toto?
No. Toto?
Toto. Yeah, good stuff. Especially the early to mid 80s stuff.
Oh, this
actually came out a little bit before that.
I will make a note, Patrick. I will make a note.
Make a note of this. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Heidi in California. Hi, Heidi.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Well, I caught the story about the woman that said that the pics was stolen from her church, and then the priest said they were going to close down the church.
Yeah.
And I recently went to a refresher class for Eucharistic ministers, and we have a newer priest. And he told us that his job, of course, is to keep or to safeguard the Eucharist. And that if we are not careful with it or allow it to be taken out, that is his responsibility. And that he could get his faculties taken away by not safeguarding the Eucharist appropriately. So anyway, that was what he told us.
Yeah, so going back to that call, I mean, it sounds to me that there's some missing piece of this puzzle, because the way the lady was describing it to me just didn't make sense, that a priest would, you know, punish the parish. Obviously, they didn't do anything.
So I thought, right. And so it was more that it wasn't the church that would be punished, but he could be punished by having his faculties taken away, by not safeguarding the Eucharist, which would then, of course, impact the rest of the parish. But it seemed, yeah, like you said, there had to be more to the story, that you don't punish the parish.
Right, right. So, that was my point.
Offer that as a different, yeah, that was a different, that he could be punished, and that was what our priests told us, and that was, you know, part of the reason why we need to be reverent and careful with the Eucharist and not let people wander around with it. So
right.
Just wanted to share that.
Very good point. No, I appreciate that. And that's a valid point you're making. Now, just to kind of springboard off what you said, I'm certain that a bishop who is, you know, attentive to the needs of his flock, that before he would remove the faculties of a priest, he would make sure that there was a priest who could make sure that masses continued and the sacraments were present and all of that. I can't imagine that a bishop would, if he needed to, under some really extreme situation, remove the faculties of the priest, that he wouldn't make provisions for the sake of the congregation. So interesting little detail there, Heidi. Thank you for that. Let's go to Rebecca now in Texas. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Hello, Rebecca.
Yes. Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
I teach a religion class for kids that are, it's their first year, they're preparing for reconciliation and First Communion. Mm-hmm. And I had a student that asked a really good question. He wanted to know, since God created the world, where did God exist, or where was he like prior to like creating the world?
Yeah, that's an interesting question to ponder. Well, I don't know how easily a second grader can understand this, but we could begin by saying, you and I for ourselves, that God is outside of time and space. So those are creatures that God made. So he doesn't exist in a place the way you and I do. He doesn't inhabit a space, so to speak. He's beyond all that. And it's hard for us to even imagine what would that be like. We can't really imagine it because there's nothing we can point to. But it is true nonetheless. So it wasn't as though God was like in this total void of emptiness. Maybe one way that the kids might be thinking of it was that before any of the stars and galaxies and all the other stuff that's floating around in the universe, before God made any of those things, it was just this gigantic, infinitely huge, empty space, and God was in there. No, he's not in a space. He's not contained within a physical three-dimensional space. He's outside of that. He's pure spirit. He transcends the world of space and time. How you talk about that to a second grader, I would say, is probably very difficult, if not impossible. So you do the best you can. But just let them know that God existed from all eternity as God, completely happy, not lacking anything, not needing anything. And this is why when God created the physical universe, he did so out of love. He didn't need any entertainment or company. He wasn't lonely, but he did this so that he could share the beauty of himself with his creation. And maybe at the, you know, second grade level, that's about all you really can say. And as they get older, you know, you can make some more nuances. But at that age, I think it'd be really hard for them to understand anything beyond
that. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate it. It's wonderful teaching the little guys, but sometimes you run into a brick wall when you're trying to explain some of these things. They just don't have the ability to understand. Let's go now to Georgia in Chicago. Hi, Georgia.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. Thanks. So I have a son in his late 20s. He's engaged. We already have, as the hand in marriage of the girl, a beautiful girl. Mm-hmm. And we are we raise him with, you know, marriage is sacred, and, you know, intimacy is reserved for marriage and so on. So I found that, you know, from time to time, he stays over with the girlfriend. Now that they're engaged, well, I don't know prior to that. And I, my husband and I need to address the issue. We addressed the issue a couple of years ago with a girlfriend he was going out with. And we made it again clear our position on that. So now they're planning to get married through the Catholic Church. She's a Catholic as well. And he a couple of times indicated that he desires to go back to the church. You know, he's been away from the church, despite being raised and educated from elementary school to college, Catholic education. And, well, I'm happy about that. We both are, my husband and I, but we're concerned about what the situation is.
Yeah. So how would you phrase this in a form of a question, Georgia, if you're asking me a question?
What would be the best way to address the situation and to offer some resources, literature about theology of the body? My son knows a whole lot about it, but it seems that right now that is not what he seemed to.
Okay, so let's start with theology of the body. This is not a theology of the body situation. This is a moral situation. So the theology of the body, it introduces people into understanding the goal or the purpose of sexual intercourse. What's the purpose of it? And fundamentally, the purpose is for begetting children. Secondarily, it's for the love and the intimacy and the friendship and even the pleasure, for that matter, that's involved for the sake of the spouses. So that's also part of it. This isn't really a theology of the body question. Rather, this is the basic gospel of Jesus, that we are all called to holiness. We are called to be a follower of Jesus. He says, come follow me. Well, what does that mean, Lord? Well, it means, among other things, remember when the rich young ruler came to Jesus in the Gospels, and we're told that he asked Jesus, good master, what must I do to enter into eternal life? And he says, if you wish to enter into eternal life, keep the commandments. Well, the commandments include the sixth and the ninth commandments, which are, in the case of the sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, the ninth commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. And the two could be subsumed within maybe a broader category of sex is intended and sexual activity is intended for marriage. So intentional sexual activity outside of marriage is sinful of whatever type. Fornication, adultery, and all the subsets that go within that. There are all kinds of different permutations or variations on a theme, and all of those would be part of that. So really, this is not a theology of the body question. This is just simply, you know, son, Jesus tells us that we are to obey the commandments. And the commandments include being pure of heart and chaste of body. Chastity pertains to your bodily actions, and purity pertains to your mental thoughts. So that's really the conversation that I would seek to have with him. And I would say just be very matter of fact, very forthright. Maybe you can have him over for dinner and sit down and say, you know, you're 27 years old, you're a grown man, you have to answer to God for your life. We've done the best we can in raising you to know right from wrong and to know the truth. And we're not going to be on the hook at the end of your life when you have to give an account for your life, because we've done everything we can do to help you. Now it's up to you. You got to live according to the gospel. You have to be a follower of Jesus or not a follower of Jesus. And if you are, then being pure and chaste is part of that until marriage. Now, when you're married, it doesn't mean that you're not going to be pure and you're not going to be chaste, but you're going to have available to you now this reality of sexual intimacy that is proper to the married state. It's not proper to you right now because you're not married yet. So get married and then enjoy this with your wife. But in the meantime, be chaste. Now, we've told you, we've shared it with you, we've referred to what Jesus says, and now it's up to you. Now, if you want to make us really happy, you're going to pursue holiness. If you want to make us really sad, you're not going to pursue holiness. But there's nothing more that we can say or do, because we've said and done everything that we need to do as your parents. Now it's up to you to stand on your own two feet. I would have that kind of a conversation with him. And then see what happens. You know, I wouldn't, you know, hover over him, but you'll be able to tell if he's going to go in the right direction or the wrong direction. But even though it will cause you some amount of personal anguish if he goes in the wrong direction, just know that you've done what you can do. Mm-hmm. And now you pray for him and ask God to help him. But I don't think, well, I can say, I know you can't fix this. You can't tell him what to do. Like the old saying goes, Georgia, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But you can put salt in his oats so that he's thirsty and he will want to drink. So maybe that conversation will help do that. I hope and pray it does, Georgia. Thank you. This is a very common thing. And God is very experienced in dealing with 27-year-old boys who want to do things that they shouldn't do. So he will help too. Thank you. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.